This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, January 29th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner. We'll speak with Jessica Hill at the Cape Cod Times, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from CAI's Mike Dean at the State House and CAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zukoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. This was the week when frustration over the vaccine rollout seemed to rear up statewide and here around the Cape as well. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us to talk about what we learned about the vaccination process this week. Hi, Jeanette. Hey, it sounds like we're going to we don't have Jeanette on the line at the moment. Her call must have dropped. I'll tell you a little bit here about the vaccination process as we're waiting for her to get back on the line. Next Monday is February 1st, and it's a date a lot of people have had circled on the calendar when it comes to vaccines. It's really the start of phase two, the state's definition of phase two, which includes people who are 75 and older. And for a lot of people, it's meant a lot of frustration as they've been looking to try to book appointments or find out when they can even book appointments online to receive their vaccination. For folks checking the state website, it's been a real challenge. To see if we have Jeanette. Jeanette Barnes, are you there?
You have Jeanette Barnes.
Hey, Jeanette.
Hi.
I was just saying that phase two starts on Monday. It's a date a lot of people have had circled on the calendar when it comes to vaccines. Tell us a little bit about what this means for folks and what it's meant for them as they're trying to access making appointments.
Right. Well, of course, the significance of phase two starting is it's really the time that members of the general public are signing up. Not everyone in the general public, of course, is eligible. Right now, you still have to be 75 or older. But people are responsible for making their own appointments without the help of an employer or something like that. And right now, the whole process is online, although, as we know, Governor Baker said yesterday that the state will have a telephone hotline. All of the appointments, no matter how you make them, are dependent upon the state and local communities getting the doses, and that has been a slow process.
So one of the challenges being that you can't make an appointment if the place where you want to get your appointment doesn't have a vaccine kind of in hand or promised in hand to deliver to you. Another big frustration point has been the online process for trying to set up an appointment. Explain for us and for anyone who hasn't clicked into this website yet what the process is like right now.
Right. Well, it's kind of a diffuse system. There are a variety of different sites to get a vaccine, pharmacies, the mass vaccination sites like Gillette, and then on the islands, the hospitals are running vaccination clinics, but that's not the case with the Cape hospitals. So the whole thing can be a little bit confusing, and there's no one funnel you can just get into to wait for, like, the first appointment and an hour's drive or something like that. So you look up the sites online, you fill out a form attesting that you are eligible, and then you choose your site, click on it, and go to kind of a separate registration system for that site. One thing I didn't initially realize is that there are actually two state websites to search for appointments. Most people have probably seen the one with the map. But there's another site also that's more like a portal hosted at a separate web address. That's maimmunizations.org. And what I like about that one is it displays more than one, the details of more than one clinic per page. You can look at more than one, and you can see more at a glance the number of appointments available at the clinics that you're viewing. So that seems a little bit more transparent to me.
Now, this week, we also heard some frustration from local officials over the rollout as well. Tell us what we heard.
Yes. Senator Julian Sear said the rollout has been a mess. That's his term. And he says the state hasn't communicated well about a few things. including the short supply of the vaccine and the fact that in the first week or two, Massachusetts probably won't actually vaccinate all people over 75 because we simply don't have the doses. You have those multiple outlets, the pharmacies and so on, but the Barnstable County sponsored clinics so far, they're only getting 975 doses a week. Cape Cod has about 67,000 residents who are 65 and older, and so clearly this is going to take some time.
Jeanette, I want to talk about a story that you broke yesterday. It has to do with Barnstable County's very first vaccination site. It's scheduled for next week, but the spaces were filled before the public was even told it was happening. Explain this.
Right. So the county health director, Sean O'Brien, was talking yesterday about how their first phase two clinic was going to be next week. And then he said, but it's already full. And I thought, wait a minute, how can it be full unless people were registering for it at the same time you told people they couldn't register yet? And it turns out the county posted the clinic online for booking on Wednesday without announcing it to the public. And O'Brien said he takes responsibility for that. He said the county wanted to have at least one clinic up there in order to kind of meet the governor's rollout schedule. Yeah, that's the story behind that, but they are going to be having them in the weeks ahead as well. So people should definitely be looking at that, that maimmunizations.org. O'Brien said some people have been just really keeping close tabs on that, looking for any appointment that comes up, and essentially that's what you have to do.
This week, Cape Cod Healthcare CEO Mike Loth talked about how phase one of the vaccine distribution, specifically to healthcare workers, has impacted his staff. More than 3,000 Cape Cod healthcare employees have gotten the vaccine. Tell us what it's like in the hospital system now.
Right. So, yes, more than 3,000 have gotten their second dose. Some more are still waiting for their second dose. Loft says here's the difference he sees already. He said last week was actually the first week since early in the pandemic that he's had no employees out of work with a diagnosis of COVID-19. So to him, yeah, it's already making a noticeable difference having the vaccine.
Another piece of news out of that conversation, Cape Cod Healthcare says it will now be processing its own COVID tests. What does that mean?
Yes, they decided to stop sending tests to Boston from the public testing clinics that they are involved in. So that's the Melody Tent Fairgrounds and some urgent care sites. Loft said they were sending those out to Boston to conserve testing materials that could be used on the Cape, but now he feels confident they have enough. So they're processing them at Cape Cod Hospital, and the result is you actually get your test results much faster, he says, 4 to 5 hours instead of up to 3 days for the Boston route.
Quicker turnaround there by far. Let me turn away from pandemic news for a moment. The company that now owns Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station has been working on its dismantling. It's interesting to hear what's going on at the plant. Tell us about this.
Yes. Holtec, which owns the plant, has been cutting up the steam dryer and separator, which are parts of the nuclear reactor. There were things that removed moisture from steam as part of the whole process. And last Monday and Tuesday, the first four boxes of those cut-up radioactive parts were shipped to Texas for disposal, and that's expected to continue through the middle of the year. These items are big. The separator, for example, is 96,000 pounds, and it's kind of interesting. The dismantling of it takes place entirely underwater, to keep it contained until they get it into a sealed box, and then it's raised from the water and loaded onto a truck. These parts, they are contaminated with radioactive material, but not as contaminated as something like spent fuel rods, which can't be shipped off the site. So that's why they're saying these parts are being shipped.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes joining us. Jeanette, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
The Martha's Vineyard Commission has a new job position, climate change planner. Martha's Vineyard Times has a profile of the woman stepping into that role, and George Brennan of the Times joins us now. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, I should say this is not just a profile of Liz Durkee, the climate change planner, but really an opportunity to look at why the island needs someone in this job.
Yeah, so Liz Durkee, you know, has been at this for a long time, even as the conservation agent in Oak Bluff. Sea level rise early on, you know, was something that she was focused on and concerned about for Oak Bluff, and that's made it a natural transition for her to become the Martha's Vineyard Commission's first climate change planner. She's really focused on climate change and what it can mean for the island and island-wide. You know, even when she was with Oak Bluff, she was, you know, thinking about how this was going to affect the entire island. And there are some really lofty goals that the commission has. They have a climate action task force that's looking to reduce fossil fuel usage on the island by 50% by 2030 and by 100% by 2040. You know, and these sort of line up with the goals that we've heard the state have and even nationally. On the island, it's imperative. We see the effects of climate change in every storm, and there's one right around the corner where we're likely to see more flooding, more damage to our coastal beaches and erosion. So very important position, and Liz seems to be the person for the job. You know, they had more than 100 applicants. She stood out among them all, according to Adam Turner, who's the MVC executive director.
Another story in the Times this week, Tisbury is looking at regulating short-term rentals, but so far it hasn't been an easy conversation.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years now since the state started taxing short-term rentals. Of course, this past summer, there wasn't a lot of people renting because of the pandemic. There were certainly some. So not quite the revenue that people expected when this all went into effect. That being said, you know, it is important for the towns to plan for this and to be ready. And Tisbury is one of the towns leading the charge on the island, looking at how to regulate this, how to get people signed up, and to make sure that they're safe. A couple of years ago, there was a pretty big fire at a place where there were a lot of people renting. And when the fire department went in, they found just a collection of extension cords and no smoke detectors, and it was a recipe for potential disaster. And luckily, there was no one seriously injured in that, but it could have been much, much worse. And so that's sort of the impetus for the town to look at this. There are some people who are short-term renters who say they rely on the income that they get from this, and this is just another thing that's going to eat into the money that they get. Meanwhile, the town is looking at a new school that's going to increase taxes, so they're feeling like they might be squeezed out. You know, the town is saying they're not really, you know, targeting those types of short-term rentals. They're concerned about the corporations who come in and they buy up property on islands like Martha's Vineyard, like Nantucket, and then all they do is rent them out short-term, and so it reduces the housing stock. And also, you know, they want to make sure that those operations are running, you know, on the up and up, like the inns and the motels that they're competing against on the island are. So that's what it's all about. There was some significant pushback. This was a public hearing. The select board did not make any decision. They've pushed it ahead to March 9th, where they'll continue the public hearing. And in that time, people can continue to, you know, provide their comments on this and get their feedback to the board.
It's George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Steve, stay warm.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. The town of Harwich is looking at the possibility of buying 31 acres for open space. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has the story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, more than half of this acreage is or was cranberry bogs. Tell us where this is and what the conversation around this is like.
Sure. The town's Real Estate and Open Space Committee, along with the Harwich Conservation Trust, are working to protect this total of 31 acres. It's the Jenkins property. It's in the Pleasant Lake section of town along Route 124 near Headwaters Drive. The property includes some forested land, and as you said, 18 acres of it is cranberry bogs. And these are some of the most scenic and visible cranberry bogs in town. They're right across from the Cape Cod Technical High School, right along Route 124, you know, in the fall when the harvesting is going on. It's a great place to stop and watch and take photos. Now, the town is looking to get $360,000 from the Community Preservation Fund toward the purchase price of $732,500. And the Harwich Conservation Trust is raising the other $440,000. And they already have a matching donation of $220,000. And they're going to be launching a fundraising effort soon for the additional $220,000. This is really a sort of prime open space to protect. The Cape Cod Rail Trail cuts through this property. It borders Hinckley's Pond, which has had nutrient loading problems in recent years. HCT Director Mike Locke said the group is exploring options for the property that include walking trails and habitat diversity improvements. He said the Jenkins family reached out to the trust about acquiring this property. They're looking to get out of the cranberry business. It's become less and less economically viable here on the Cape in recent years, and they're looking to repurpose this land in a way that will benefit the community. In the recent years, the trust and the town have purchased a number of cranberry bogs, most of which are being allowed to return to nature. Whether this bog will continue to be farmed or will be allowed to revert to its natural state, we don't know yet. It's still a little early. But Mike Locke said if the trust financing falls into line, the property will end up being owned by the trust, with the town holding conservation restrictions on these parcels.
Tim, a quick mention here of another story in the paper. A Harwich family adopting a new puppy. Why is it news? In part because it's just such a nice little story. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's a great story. The Eldridge family of Harwich, they were looking for, they felt during the pandemic that they wanted to adopt a dog. Everybody was home. It seemed like the right time, they said. The problem was that there are very few dogs available from local shelters, and they wanted a rescue dog. So during a family Zoom on Thanksgiving, Cheryl Eldridge learned about a Facebook dog, for Dogs and Cats of Antigua. It's a nonprofit on Caribbean Island, and they were able to find a puppy that fit their needs. They had to figure out a way to get the puppy to Harwich, however. That's where Susan Peavy, who's a local travel agent, came into the picture. She knew Cheryl's husband, Matt, and she happened to be going to Antigua in December for a travel event, and she volunteered to be a courier for the puppy. And on December 15th, Matt Eldridge met her at Logan Airport, and the family adopted the puppy, who they named Bear, and Bear's looking pretty good right now. The Eldridges say that true to his Caribbean roots, he loves to run on the beach and pick up seashells. So it's a really heartwarming sort of pandemic story that we don't hear enough of these days.
And if you want to see a real cute picture, look over on CapeCodChronicle.com, where you can see Matt Eldridge and Bear meeting at Logan Airport on December 15th. Great picture. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Steve.
Even before the recent uptick in COVID cases showed up in test results, there was an indication it was coming in Provincetown. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner has this story. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Marianne, high virus levels were detected in the town's sewage, tipping off public health officials. Tell us about this. Provincetown is only one of a few places in our region doing this kind of sewage testing.
That's right. So it started back in August. The town issued a notice that the company that operates the treatment plant and the whole town's sewer system would begin testing for the virus SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that is responsible for COVID-19. And back in August, actually throughout the summer, we really, as a town, even though there are lots of people coming and going as tourists, had relatively low active COVID cases. So the testing started out just establishing baselines, and then seemed to go along, with kind of just minor blips here and there in terms of indicating cases, more cases in town than what were recorded. But by about November, the indicators at the wastewater treatment plant showed that there was kind of a steady uptick in cases. And really, we're now up in kind of, where are we here, end of January, up to 9 active cases. But part of this is that the idea with the testing at the wastewater system is that, not to be too explicit, but the virus is shed in the stool of people who are either, actively have symptoms, are pre-symptomatic, or have no symptoms at all. So it's the idea is that what is indicated at the wastewater is kind of an indicator of what to be expected in about a week or so in the future.
It's kind of amazing that within the whole population of the town, if you say we have 9 active cases here, that they're able to detect that within the whole wastewater system. I find that impressive. And yet not all of the houses in Provincetown are on this system. Is that right?
That's right. So the sewer system, it accounts for about 1,000 properties, which is about 50% of the entire town. But the key thing, I think, is that that 50% that's on the sewer system is all the downtown properties all along the busy commercial street and really kind of the densest part of town. So I think it's a good indicator, a decent indicator. The other thing the health agent had said is that right now, Outer Cape Health Services is offering free antigen tests for anybody, whether, if they even don't even have any symptoms at all. So the indications that they get from the wastewater allow the health department to kind of put out an alert to ask people to go ahead, if they're worried at all, to go ahead and sign up for a free antigen test at Outer Cape Health Services.
There was a mention from the Board of Health about an indoor dinner party perhaps being a spread point for COVID. Can you tell us a little bit about what we know about this?
Well, let's see. So we're up to, I think it was last night I checked, it was 9 cases. I don't know a ton about that. They do tell us a little bit, like the previous uptick, like in November, had to do more with people who were traveling out of state. So this one, the further uptick is related to an indoor dinner party. I actually don't know that much more about it. And they also said that they're seeing cases within families. So that has to do, they thought, with also just the fact that there's increased testing available now, too.
This is Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner joining us this morning. Marianne, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe's former tribal council chairman has filed a motion to dismiss charges brought against him. Jessica Hill of the Cape Cod Times joins us with this story and more. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. This is Cedric Cromwell, of course, we're talking about. He's facing federal indictment on a number of charges. Now he's asking for at least some of those to be dismissed. Tell us what this is about here.
Sure. So on January 19th, he, as well as David DeQuatro, who owns an architecture firm in Rhode Island that was hired to work on a number of tribal projects, they both filed motions to dismiss some of the charges. DeQuatro filed for all of his charges to be dismissed. Way back in November, they were charged on two counts of accepting or paying bribes as an agent of an Indian tribal government and one count of conspiring to commit bribery. And Cromwell was also indicted on four charges of extortion under color of official right and one count of conspiring to commit extortion. And ever since that they filed those charges, a couple of days ago, the U.S. District Attorney's Office, who's the prosecutor in the case, they filed another motion to oppose the defendant's motions to dismiss. Assistant U.S. Attorney Christine Wickers, she argues that DeQuatro allegedly gave payments and in-kind benefits to Cromwell in exchange for Cromwell using his influence as chairman of the tribal council, as well as president of the tribe's gaming authority, to ensure that DeQuatro's contract was not terminated with the tribe.
So part of the argument here that's a little bit interesting is that it's not about the district attorney's office is saying this is not about what Cromwell is said to have done, but really what he is said to have kept from happening.
Exactly, yeah. So they're basically, the U.S. attorney's office is saying that because he used his role to kind of help DeQuatro from not losing his contract or terminate his contract, that in itself is using like an official act in his role, which is what they argue is against the law.
This is going to be in court for a while. What's the next step, just so folks have an idea?
Yeah, so the next hearing is scheduled for February 4th, which is coming up pretty soon. DeQuatro's attorney just filed a motion to respond to the U.S. attorney's opposition to dismiss. So they'll be filing another motion as well pretty soon.
I want to talk about another story you reported. It takes as its starting place the disappearance of a young woman from the Cape. Her name was Jalayla Finkley. This happened in October, and you talked about the case with us on the roundup back then. But your article this week pulls back to look at the larger issue of what happens when young people of color go missing, and it points to a real disparity.
Definitely. So true. I found that with missing person cases involving people of color, they're much less likely to be solved than those who are white and go missing, particularly women of color. And Native women, they are much more likely to go missing and unsolved at a much higher rate.
Some of these, you kind of break this down to explain why this happens, and some of it has to do with how people are classified when they're reported as missing.
Right. So oftentimes when a person of color or a child of color is reported missing, they're often classified as a runaway, which is really key in. If you're classified as a runaway, you don't receive like the Amber Alert or any type of media coverage. And honestly, awareness is key in finding people who go missing. With Jalayla Finkley, for example, when she first went missing, a lot of rumors spread on social media saying like, oh, she ran away. Don't worry about it. And that's just a really prime example of how it is very common that that will happen with people of color who go missing. And then oftentimes also people of color are assumed to be like involved in some criminal activity, and therefore they're not deemed worthy enough to be found. And sometimes police will also have an impact in that as well.
I thought it was interesting that how the media covers missing people also has a big impact on this.
Yes, I talked with Martin Reynolds, who is the co-executive director of the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education, and he was really talking about how it really stems from a long-term systemic approach in covering communities of color. If media organizations, only cover people of color when it hovers around crime and violence or they're being impoverished or navigating addiction, that can really bring about this subconscious devaluation of people of color in those communities. So then when it comes time for to cover like a person of color who goes missing, the urgency and the value placed on those members of the community are just not present.
Tell us a little bit about what suggestions are in play about how this can be changed to impact the system to better represent these people who go missing.
Yeah, so it really stems from covering communities of color more in depth, you know, covering every single thing from like how they, you know, contribute to society, different cultural things, really just making it more well-rounded rather than all the negative stories. And then also, obviously, diversity in newsrooms. It was something that Reynolds mentioned is crucial. When you have someone of, you know, a diverse background, they could really help bring about changes and notice when something is wrong in how we cover certain things. So that's a lot of it right there.
One of the things that your story points to here, the story of Jalaja Finkley has a tragic ending. She was found dead, and her abductor was killed in a shootout with police. But in one sense, her family got what the family of many missing people of color don't get. They got some closure.
Exactly, yeah. It was terrible tragedy and super heartbreaking to, you know, hear about this case and, you know, learn that Finkley was found dead. But at the same time, however unfortunate it is that they did, you know, get closure and they could start the healing process. But so many people of color, especially Indigenous women, so oftentimes their cases go unsolved and their families have no answers.
It is Jessica Hill of the Cape Cod Times joining us. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. On Martha's Vineyard, a coalition has come together to revisit an idea that's been around for a while, forming a housing bank to try to tackle issues of affordable housing. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us to talk about this. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, as I've suggested here, we've heard this idea before, but this time around the folks behind it believe it has a real chance to succeed, which it hasn't in the past. Tell us what they're proposing and why they feel like this is different.
So the proposal this year is actually similar to a proposal that came about in 2005. That was the first sort of housing bank proposal. And the goal is to model something after the Martha's Vineyard Land Bank and have the bank funded through a distinct transfer fee on real estate transactions. That's how the land bank's funded. There's a 2% transfer fee on buyers. And that's sort of what the plan is for this land bank or this housing bank proposal. But there are some distinct differences between that and between a proposal that came about in 2018 that also was for a housing bank but had a completely different funding source.
So it's come up twice before, 2005 and 2018. This time it seems like the folks behind this have really looked to the past to see why it didn't work as they try to shape how to go forward with this time.
Yeah, no question. It seems like there's some lessons that were learned. Two of the biggest differences are that, at least right now, there's actually six other towns in the Commonwealth that have already filed home rule petitions that are based on real estate transfer fees and would function similarly to a land bank but be used for housing. Those include Nantucket, Provincetown, Boston, Somerville, Brookline, Concord. I think that's all six. And so the people who are founding this coalition on the island, they said that having a statewide coalition provides more ballast when the proposal does eventually arrive on Beacon Hill. And then another difference is that they're not planning to bring forth legislation until 2022. So they still are sort of looking at a 24-month plan. Last, in 2018, when the second housing bank proposal came about on the island, that was inspired by the passage of a short-term rental tax. And the people behind that proposal felt that they needed to pass it right away because otherwise sort of the opportunity would be fleeting. And so that only gave them 4 months to do it. But this time, if they have 2 years, they feel like they have a lot more time to flesh out details. Not everything needs to be set in stone right now. They can go and coordinate with local and state leaders and make sure that the proposal is not rushed.
One of the things that they're pointing to here is that this year saw a record-breaking figure for real estate sales on the island.
Yeah, I think that there's no question that this is at least in part spurred by the booming totally pandemic-fueled real estate market here. You know, you can only publish so many articles in the paper that say, you know, real estate volume is over $1 billion on the island before people are like, well, we really do need to do something about this. And that was what the co-chairs of the group said in an interview this week. You know, you could, it's on the one hand, in some sense, it's good for the local economy, but there are huge impacts that are had by a massive booming real estate market. That said, the price of housing has totally skyrocketed. I think in 2010, the median price for a home on the island was $500,000, and now it's over $1 million. And that's just, that's a doubling in 10 years. I mean, and even in less time than when previous housing pay proposals had come about. So it just kind of goes to show that there really is sort of a fire behind the movement. And it almost was sort of like a, you know, it seems conveniently timed in that sense. No question about that.
Tell us a little bit about the range of folks behind this. It really is kind of a broad coalition.
It is. There is some overlap with the 2018 housing bank proposal, but it does seem like it's a totally different group here. The two co-chairs, one is on the Edgartown, or is an administrator for the Edgartown Affordable Housing Committee. The other is the former executive director of Martha's Vineyard Community Services on the island. So both are pretty familiar and have been pretty hands-on with housing issues, you know, trying to staff community services. You know, there's 100 people who work there. It has always been a struggle. And you see firsthand the impacts of people who don't have permanent housing on the island. And a big difference, too, is that now there are local officials that are involved. It's, you know, it is sort of a different panoply of people. You know, there are builders. There are people involved in the trades. And that's sort of, it's a broad coalition. It does seem, and the whole plan is to be able to have a separate steering committee in each town on the island. So eventually they hope to have 6 different steering committees that can each get town meeting warrant articles passed, which is, you know, always the problem with the island is getting something done on an island-wide basis because you need to do it in 6 towns. But it sounds like that's the goal moving forward.
So, Noah, you said they're looking at maybe 24 months to try to accomplish this. Briefly,
yeah.
What is the forward path look like? What's going to happen next for this group?
Well, the first step, according to the co-chairs, is to go before all the town select boards. And then it's sort of to see how many people are interested in joining in the effort, forming the town-specific groups, and then working with the state legislators or the Cape and Islands State Legislative Delegation and trying to write the legislation that eventually they hope to pass on town meeting warrant articles and then at the state level. So it really is a long process. I think that it's going to take money. It's going to take even fundraising. The coalition doesn't have a budget yet. They estimate costs somewhere between $250,000 and $300,000. And so there's a lot of different, you know, moving parts that need to come together over the next 2 years. But that's kind of the benefit of it being 2 years. It gives time and the opportunity to be able to do that.
Noah Asmo, The Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Governor Charlie Baker has received a lot of criticism the past few weeks for how COVID-19 vaccines are being rolled out in the state. He made changes this week to move people 65 and up a little closer to the front of the line, so to speak. But Baker faced criticism again when the new online vaccine registration system debuted, and not everyone found it easy to use. We heard earlier how this was playing out locally. Now, here's CAI's Catherine Ident talking with our State House reporter Mike Dean about how the state is addressing it.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Well, we are wrapping up phase one of the governor's COVID-19 vaccine rollout plan. We're about to start phase two, and that is going to reach a broader swath of Massachusetts residents. One of these groups, those aged 65 and up, they've been moved up a little bit closer to the start of the line, but really, those 75 and up are in line first.
Yes, yeah, it's 75 and older is the first stage of this second phase. I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes in, is that there's only 4 phases to the vaccination rollout, and there's a lot of smaller steps within those phases, and those are priority based. So when phase two starts on Monday morning, that is when 75 years and older kicks in and they can start getting those shots. What Baker did when he changed that lineup, so to speak, was he prioritized 65 and older individuals. But we don't know exactly when that's going to kick in, because the governor in this plan in general has been focusing on one group at a time. So then we're going to have, you know, the phase two, part two, so to speak, and that's going to be when people are going to be 65 years and older, also with people with more than one comorbidity. That's people who, you know, will be more vulnerable to the virus if they get it, could be deadlier for them. And then there are, you know, beyond that, a number of other kind of professions that will come in after that. People like, you know, public education teachers, K through 12, food service. So, you know, just to be clear on that, though, that 65 and up segment of the population isn't going to kick in for, you know, weeks. We're not really sure, because Baker has not laid out exactly when these steps within phase two are going to begin.
Well, the governor also plans to open dozens of new vaccination sites across the state, and that will greatly increase the state's capacity. But Baker's saying what's slowing them up now is the federal supply chain. The vaccines aren't coming fast enough.
Exactly. And that's a point that Baker has been repeating over and over again, is that the state can set up these sites. They're setting up, you know, kind of mega sites, they're calling them. Fenway Park in Boston, the Gillette Stadium are going to be the kind of mega vaccination sites. And then there are going to be dozens and dozens of smaller public sites scattered around the state. But they can't do anything unless the federal supply of vaccines is available to these sites. And that's just something that the state has had a devil of a time finding out from the federal government how much vaccine to expect. Baker has said it's basically a week-by-week planning process. You know, you can't open up a Gillette Stadium and say you're going to do 100,000, you know, shots a week. If you don't know that you're going to have the vaccine that to fill those syringes. And that is what's leading to problems with appointments on this new website. You can't make an appointment at a site unless there is a supply that they can rely on.
Right. And I want to talk a little bit about the site, because there's been some complaints across the state, especially with older folks who may not be as savvy navigating the internet. It's a map, not a portal.
Earlier on in the week, Baker was insisting that it is a centralized approach. It is one website. That's true. Earlier on in the week, Baker was saying that that is about as centralized as you could ever want. However, it's one centralized website that then lists dozens and up to 100 individual sites that you have to go and book from there. And when we have a situation where each individual site doesn't know if they're going to be able to book appointments, again, because of that lack of transparency on the federal supply, then that means that you could go to the website, find the place closest to you, get no luck there, go to the next one, no luck there, and go on this process over and over again. Later on in the week, Baker did voice some empathy with what people are going through. He said he realizes that it will be frustrating to go through this website process to book your vaccination, but he asked that people be patient, and he admitted that, yes, it will probably take a few times through this process before you can successfully book an appointment for a vaccination.
Yeah, with each site having a slightly different registration process, it could be confusing and disorienting for some folks in those older age brackets.
Absolutely. You know, we've seen this problem over and over again with accessing online tools and things like that.
There's been lots of talk about the federal supply chain here, but Massachusetts is in the lower 50% of states in the whole U.S., and it's the worst performing in New England when it comes to the amount of the population that's been vaccinated. Is Baker simply saying that's because of the federal supply chain? What's the answer here?
A lot of that has to do with how limited phase one of this process was. Because phase one concentrated on, you know, medical workers, first responders, it really was targeted, and it only focused on those few classifications. Now, phase one was a successful phase. It looks like, you know, nearly every first responder and hospital worker and everyone who was eligible has received it, unless they've refused, and that's why the state is now moving into the much, much broader phase two. Other states that had more eligible individuals in their phase one obviously have more people vaccinated. Massachusetts and Charlie Baker rolled this plan out back in December. It's been the plan this whole time. But a lot of people have now come to think that it was just far too limited, and we're having trouble ramping it up because of that federal supply.
And that is CAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks a lot. As always, have a great weekend.
You too, Catherine.
CAI's Catherine Iden speaking there with Mike Dean. The latest protections to save critically endangered right whales include a seasonal ban on commercial lobster fishing in nearly all Massachusetts waters. CAI's environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff joins us now to explain the new regulations and what they will mean. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, let's talk first about how we got here. We're talking about a massive closure for lobstermen. Why such an extreme measure?
Yeah, well, I think we have to start by talking about the plight of the whales. The reason that this closure will happen is because entanglement in rope and fishing gear is a leading cause of death for this critically endangered species. In the last 3 years, at least 8 have died from entanglement, 5 have been seriously injured, and those are significant numbers in a population that has plummeted to 360. And in fact, given those numbers, the state actually needs to prove to the federal government that we are doing what we can to protect the whales. And a lot is at stake. If the state is unsuccessful in proving that, a federal judge could simply shut down the fishery for the entire year. It's a lot more than a 3-month closure. And the judge could do that under the powers of the Endangered Species Act.
So many Massachusetts lobstermen have already been facing some version of a closure. Explain to us the details of this closure, why it's so much bigger, and what it encompasses.
Yeah, that's right. So for 3 months of the year right now, Cape Cod Bay, basically the waters around Cape Cod Bay, are closed to lobster fishermen. This is different. This will apply from mid-February into mid-May to waters that kind of extend from Cape Cod Bay north to the New Hampshire border. This is a much, much bigger closure. Though there is an exemption for waters in Nantucket Sound because right whales are really rarely seen there. And I should also mention the advisory commission that issued these measures also laid the groundwork to experiment with ropeless fishing technology and mandated that fishermen use weak rope that breaks when a right whale is entangled to kind of add to the suite of protections for right whales. And also to create some opportunities for fishermen to make this a little bit easier, maybe, going forward. So this will be hard on fishermen, without a doubt.
The Massachusetts lobster industry has been struggling and saying that it's struggling, and no doubt having increased closures is only going to add to that pain. I want to ask you to tell us, we have just about a minute here, tell us a little bit more about two things you mentioned here, ropeless fishing technology and maybe this breaking strength rope that they're mandating.
Yeah, so breaking strength rope, just briefly, is rope that at 1,700 pounds of pressure will just fall apart. So a right whale that gets entangled, an adult right whale, I should say, that gets entangled can free itself from the rope. Ropeless fishing is more popular among many conservationists because it takes the ropes out of the water. It allows lobstermen to send an acoustic signal from their boats to their traps so that there is never a rope in the water connecting a trap to a buoy. The acoustic signal tells the trap, all right, it's time to shoot up to the surface with the help of an airbag or a buoy, and that is how lobstermen get their traps. It's a really exciting technology, and CAI listeners will be able to hear more about it, a lot more about it, next week. So they should tune in Monday and Tuesday to learn a lot more.
That's CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Mary Ann Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, and Jessica Hill at the Cape Cod Times, Noah Asimow at the Vineyard Gazette, and we heard from Mike Dean at the State House. Big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio making this all come together so nicely. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.